Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food farming and the future of our food system and our environment. Here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, you're listening to us here at WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community out of Baltimore, Maryland, and, of course, broadcast as well at Marvel Public Radio on the Eastern Shore. We are going to examine the questions of the GMOs. And there's been some interesting articles written. One, the author's with us, Can GMOs Help Feed a Hot and Hungry World, that appeared in the Nation magazine. And then I also stumbled across Seeds of Doubt, written by Michael Spector, in a recent New Yorker magazine, that kind of takes on Vandana Shiva and this whole question of GMOs being dangerous. A lot of issues have been raised. The public is really wrestling with this in many ways. So we are joined here right now by Madeline Ostrander, who is a contributing editor to Yes Magazine, freelance writer based out of Seattle, Washington, who wrote the article we just talked about in The Nation, Can GMOs Feed a Hot and Hungry World? Patty Lavera is back with us once again, assistant director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates the food team. And we'll be joined by Dr. Eduardo Blumwald, who is featured in that article, who is professor of cell biology and the Will W. Lester Chair of the Department of Plant Sciences at the University of California, Davis, where he studies genetic engineering. So, folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
And please join us here at 410-319-8888. Rachel is here at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to my Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. Madeline, I really enjoyed your article. I thought that, and I'm curious, A, what pushed you to write this article, this whole question of the battles taking place around the United States on labeling GMOs, I think have most Americans very confused about what all this really means. So talk a bit about what you looked at and why.
Yeah, sure. Well, a few months ago, one of my editors at The Nation approached me and asked if I would consider writing a story about the science of genetic engineering. And I actually have a bit of a science background myself. One of my majors in college was biology. And I didn't have a lot of preconceived notions about biotechnology. I didn't think it was horrible, as, you know, members of the public seem to think. I didn't think that it would by itself save the world. I know that a lot of people, including myself, are concerned about the state of agriculture. They're concerned about the way pesticides and herbicides are used. They're concerned about sustainability. And they're especially concerned about who controls our food and what goes into it. Most of the genetically engineered products that are out on the market today are made by large corporations like Monsanto, and there's this idea that that's all biotechnology can ever be. But I wanted to go into the story from a different way. I wanted to look at the basic science of biotechnology and of genetic engineering. And the basic science is about how do we, you know, use what we know about genes to alter the way that, you know, the characteristics of a plant and the way that it behaves and the things about the plant make it more useful to us. And in some ways, that's what agriculture has been doing for millennia. And so this story was a way of asking, if you go back to the basic science, if you look at what particular research is doing, especially at universities, could genetic engineering help us deal with some of the very urgent crises we are facing in farming, including climate change? And what I found was that, yes, there are all sorts of innovations being researched in genetic engineering, many of which we don't hear about and which are not making it out into the world for any number of reasons. Some of it has to do with negative public opinion. Some of it has to do with the high cost of testing. Some of it has to do with the ways that agriculture is dominated by a few large companies. And so most of the research on genetic engineering is focused on a few profitable traits and some of the most commonly grown crops.
So, and we're also joined here by Dr. Eduardo Blumwald, I announced a moment ago, who is a key in this article, and Pat Lavera from Food and Water Watch. But one of the things that I think the world is going to wrestle with in the next, right now, and in the next 50 years, is how we feed the world's population. All the stats I've been reading say that we will have to produce more food than ever in human history to feed the people on less land than we've ever had to use before, because our land is so truncated in terms of where farming takes place. And with the rise of climate change and changing weather patterns and changing monsoons and all the rest that affect how we grow our foods. So before I turn to Dr. Eduardo Blumwald, Patty Lavera, some people are beginning to question, are all genetically modified organisms, all genetically engineered foods, bad? Is this a wrong way to go all the time? Or are we talking about something because it's Monsanto or Dow who have this history of making these killer products, destroying the earth, but also want to have patents to control everything that a farmer does and all the seeds they use? Where does it live for you?
Well, it's hard to separate all of that because that's, to date, that's what we've seen from, you know, from the supposedly revolutionary breakthroughs in you know, getting away from conventional breeding and the things that we've always done. It's been brought to us by these companies, and they've also designed the system for how they're approved. So we don't have a regulatory system that we have any faith in that it's evaluating whether they're safe or not. We have a system that's very, very captured, and it's been designed by these companies that are making money off these technologies. So before we can answer that question, we have to really redesign the regulatory apparatus for how we evaluate these things. And we do worry that this really kind of takes up all the oxygen in the room, and we're not having a discussion about farming systems or the, you know, the lots of other factors about how and where and what farmers around the world produce. And to date, you know, the talk about the role of biotechnology in feeding a growing planet has really been about U.S. companies exporting industrialized agriculture methods, and we don't think that making farmers in developing countries farm like they're in Iowa makes a lot of sense for anybody except those companies that are really pushing this agenda. So it's very hard to separate all of that for us, and we need to see a much more honest, open debate about it than what we're seeing. Right now what we're seeing is science that's largely done by the companies that want to sell something and regulators that are totally okay with that and don't have any ability to do an independent review. So we can't evaluate that in the current system that we have.
So Doctor, let me come now to Dr. Eduardo Blumwald, and welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you heard Patty Lavera, and I was reading what you were writing on the article. So what about this issue? Of it, is it genetically? Is it genetic engineering is the issue? Is it the corporatization of that genetic engineering the issue? And are there things we have to put in place first before any of it can come? Any of it should be allowed to come to fore.
Before answering you, if you don't mind, why we don't put a bit of clarity on the terms that you are using? We are talking about a regulatory process. And a regulatory process that we can trust. Well, let's start that the regulatory process is not depending in Monsanto or none of the companies. The regulatory process depends on governmental entities, people that we vote. Let's start with that. So or EPA or USDA or the Drug and Food Administration, those are authorities that we vote. That's us, theoretically, if we believe in democracy. So what I think that companies, what they are doing is a business. And they are trying to buy the seed companies and buy whatever they can buy and in order to make money. When two phone companies, when Apple and I don't know who else, Samsung or whoever it is, they fight with each other and they pay each other billions of dollars for the right of a phone, we say, okay, they want to make money. But if I will go and take the phone away from you, you're going to be very upset. In this world, it's business. And unfortunately, we people that work, we have very little to say about that. We still can vote, and we still can choose our authorities. The process is not so alienated. What makes all of this so convoluted? I think that our fear and our ignorance. If we are ignorant and we believe what anybody will tell you, then you are going to be so fearful that you are going to accept anything. So if somebody starts with the notion that transgenic foods are bad for you and they are dangerous, and then they start imposing a number of N limitations, which are very expensive, and only big biotech companies can buy, well, now we are really carving our own cave there, And we are going deep on them, and we can do nothing. To be clear.
But the question is, I think, for people who kind of...
I want to answer your question. And your question is, are GMOs safe? Yes, absolutely. How I know? Well, we have GMOs for 30 years or more, and I do not know, I am not aware, and I would love somebody to send me any note or any evidence if they have, there has been one case, I mean one case of somebody that got even sick of ingesting GMO food.
So let me just interrupt for a moment so I can let Patty come back before we turn back to Madeline. Patty?
I mean, about the long term, I mean, we hear this a lot. This is a favorite line from, you know, especially from the biotech industry. And our answer to that is that it's nobody's job to look. We don't tell people they're eating it because it's not disclosed in the food.
Just one at a time, please. Patty, finish.
And, you know, and this is, I don't know of anybody who's saying, you know, we don't say that GMOs cause X problem or Y problem, but we don't have a system to track post-market effects. We have that system for drugs. People know that they took a drug. We don't have a comparable system for these foods. So just pointing at the track record and saying, oh, we can't identify a specific problem is not good enough. That is backwards. We should be looking at long-term safety before we put it on the market, not trying to track
it to see
if we can find it later.
Edward, I really, we have to only have one at a time because on radio, if two voices are talking, nobody can hear.
Okay, sorry. I thought we were going to...
I just want to let Patty finish. Patty, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I will keep quiet.
Enough.
Are you finished, Patty?
Sure.
Okay, I'm sorry. Eduardo.
It's my turn.
Yes.
Okay. What I'm saying is there is a bunch of arguments that are really are almost absurd in the sense that we can track... We can go to any hospital if we want. We can go to any place. We can put an ad in the paper and ask, hey, if you ate this or that for the last 10, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, come and tell us. I don't think that is a problem. The problem is that we are mixing our... if you want, sentiment against multinationals and companies and all that, which is a political problem, with a real need that we have to feed 9 billion people in 30 years.
So, but it seems to me that here's a question that seems to come out of this, and I think that, you know, Madeline, when you wrote your piece, and the other piece I read in the New Yorker, which was kind of attacking Vandana Shiva pretty strongly by the end of the article. But at any rate, the question being raised in these other articles is it a question of the genetic engineering of food? Is it a question of corporate control? Is it a question, as Patty Lavera is saying, that we can't really have any of this until we talk about regulations and understanding what this food does or doesn't do in the long term, because none of those things are put in place? I mean, I think that's why this is so confusing and troubling for most people trying to put their hands around this.
Yeah, but the problem is...
I'm asking Madeline. Madeline?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I think that that's basically what the story was trying to get. I think that people are muddling a whole set of issues that I think should be considered as separate issues. So, you know, the question of which industries control food is one question. The question of what kinds of herbicides, pesticides, and chemicals are applied to our food is another question. And the question of the technology itself and is it safe is yet another question. A number of large scientific organizations, including the National Academy of Sciences, that have been concluded that, you know, genetically engineered food itself is to consume. But, you know, that doesn't mean every variety that we would ever produce always automatically be safe. Yes, there does need to be some sort of testing regime that people feel comfortable with. And apparently, no one I interviewed seemed to be very happy with the way that testing and regulation of genetic engineering is done. I think the scientists I spoke with felt that the process was too onerous and didn't really reflect the science. But, you know, there's a lot of the testing that the FDA asks biotech researchers to go through when they're developing genetically engineered food, but it's the same standards are not applied to, say, food that's modified just by zapping it with radiation. which is a much less controlled process. And so I think we need to really get back to the basic science and have a conversation about what it looks like and what it means. And what I was trying to accomplish in the article is bring people back to that, because I fear that the dialogue is getting very skewed and people are mixing up what part of inherent to the technology, parts of these problems are political and have to do with the practices of agriculture themselves.
Well, I was just very curious very quickly, but Patty and Eduardo, Eduardo, let me ask you this very quick question, go back to Patty. I mean, is there a question that we shouldn't have more oversight and regulation to make sure what's on the product, what's being given to farmers to use is actually safe in the long run? Tests have not been done, and no matter what we think has happened or not happened. And B, when you look at this, is the question of corporate control of all the food and agriculture, of the seeds, the very life itself that goes into our food. Those seem to me to be two of the biggest issues that Patty and many others are raising.
Those issues are separate.
I don't care if they're separate or not. They're both. Those are the issues, though, that people are concerned about.
Yeah, but you have to deal with them separate. Let's go one by one, if you want. Regarding the regulations, I think that GMOs are over-regulated, not under-regulated. In fact, the cost of regulation is what make the companies like Monsanto so powerful. We are putting so much regulatory issues here and constraints here that the only ones that can pay are the four or five or six big biotech companies. Small biotech companies cannot pay for that. If you want to bring one transgenic crop to the market, you need, just to go through the regulatory process, $100 million. And a small company cannot pay for it. So in a way, we are feeding the dragon. The more difficult we make this, well, thank you very much. Actually, Monsanto is very happy because they have the lawyers, they have the money, they are the only ones that can pay. So a small company that has a great invention has no other way than sell it to Monsanto.
Okay.
So we are making them, with our ignorance, we are making this company so powerful, number one. When I say over-regulated, I mean over-regulated. There are three agencies. It's incredible, the complexity of the regulatory process. Golden Rice is the best example. We have the product years ago, and it's still not deregulated. Still is going on.
So let me stop here for a moment. I want Patty to get a chance to come in. We'll come back to the second point in a moment. Patty, the question of the regulation that he was raising and the question of Golden Rice is an interesting question, but go ahead, Patty.
I would agree it's a complex regulatory chart. There's three agencies that have a piece of the action when you're talking about a new genetically engineered crop, but sadly that does not equal good protection, we think, for the public and for the environment. It's a complicated flowchart, but nobody has independent review authority. They're dealing with data that comes from these companies, and we think that's by design. There have been several conversations over the years in Washington about what is the right way to regulate these things, and they never result in a new system. We think in part because of the political, not in part, probably entirely, due to the political power of these big companies. And I also agree that these companies are too powerful. I would say that's not because of the regulatory system, which I don't think is overburdensome. I think it's a complete lack of taking on the antitrust issues that are involved in these companies who have bought up all their competitors. So, you know, fixing competitive issues, competitive problems, or lack of competition in this market isn't going to happen through deregulation and less demands on bringing in a new technology to the marketplace. Is going to come from antitrust enforcement and making these companies play fairly, which they currently do not. You know, and there's a whole other piece of this, which is where support for testing and research comes from. And right now it's coming from private money. It's coming from these companies. And what public money does get spent on this, we think, is not looking at alternatives, not looking at long-term health and safety stuff. It ends up funding the same kind of stuff for new genetically engineered crops. So we need to have a whole conversation about public support for research and what kind of research gets done with that money. It's shrinking, but there is still public money, and we have to spend it, we think, in a more holistic way rather than just the latest, you know, technological quick fix, which may or may not do what we need.
So let me open the phone so you get a caller in before we run out. So 1 second, 410-319-8888. Frank, you're on the air.
Yeah, peace. So as far as the GMOs go, I really don't really have the specialties to speak on them, but what I do know is for all the vegans and vegetarians out here that want to stay away from food that bring death, as far as like killing your food in an improper way, then you want to put that frustration at the food that you're eating in your body. Now they want to go out here and manipulate the DNA of raw vegetables and fruits and vegetables, things of that nature. It's like, it's not playing fair at all, because for real, anybody can go and buy a 5-gallon bucket and put some dirt in it and grow your vegetables and your fruits. So why should we allow them to come to the market, which fruits grow so plentiful? There's no reason for them to put GMOs in fruits. Now, the meat, for people that love meat, such as myself, that might serve as a challenge, because, you know, everybody wants chicken box. I can eat that almost all week.
Not all of us want a chicken box. Yeah, I hear you. So, not after I've seen how they raise those chickens, I don't want a chicken box anymore. But
yeah, that's how I demand, though. Yes, sir.
But let me go back to what he was saying here, and I think, Madeline, I this is to me a very critical conversation for us to have, in terms of the science of genetic engineering, which I think is one subject, the question of the regulations, and the question of corporate control, and then the question of, are we even putting any money into investing into alternatives beyond all that? I mean, that is a complexity of this that I think we cannot do here in 25 minutes. That's going to require much longer, more in-depth studies and conversations. Madeline?
Yeah, that's right. One of the things I thought that was interesting in the process of writing this article is when I spoke to food activists, including food activists, you know, run some pretty significant campaigns against genetic engineering in California. There was, both from some scientists I talked to and from some of the food activists, an agreement that we need a more sustainable food system. That there could be some promise in this technology if we could ever sort out the political and legal and issues around these technologies. And I think what concerns me is that we're not having enough dialogue about the science and about fundamental issues. We're getting lost in a sort of questions about how we feel about Monsanto. And while I think that it's important to ask how we feel about, you know, big companies having such influence on our food, I think it's also important to have a conversation about what kind of tools science offers us as we're trying to solve the problems of agriculture. And genetic engineering is just one tool. It's certainly not the only tool in agriculture in facing the kinds of crises that, you know, we're coming up against.
So very quickly, because we have about a minute left, we have to take a break here and go to another segment, but we will come back to this in much longer conversations. I think we really need to do this in Pat Oliveira, because I think we only got to the surface that was at the heart of all the issues that are really confusing and troubling people in America, I think.
Yeah, and I think the important issue is, I mean, no technology exists in a vacuum. It matters how it's used and who owns it and what the rules are. And so while it's nice to say we can talk just about the science, people's lives are going to be impacted by how that science is used and how it's deployed and who controls it. So we do have to tackle all of these pieces of it and not just, you know, isolate one part.
I think that there's a world of science, as Patty was saying. We have to run out of time here, Dr. Blumwald, but I think that's part of it that we do not get. And I think that's part of it we have to understand in a greater depth as well.
Yeah, but also, you have to be very careful. Not because you say too many times a lie becomes the truth. The big biotech companies are not supporting our research. They don't put a penny, actually, in our research. I don't know where it comes from. The fact that activists are mixing the science in the university, public university, paying our riches is paying by your tax money, to and to make believe that we are just working in total conjunction with the industry. It's just a bunch of lies.
Well, I mean, and I know that, there are a number of independent researchers out there. I think, and I'm going to invite all of you to come back in the coming weeks, because I really want to explore this in greater depth for a longer period of time, not just in a short period we had today on this program. I really appreciate the writing you were doing, Madeline Ostrander, and we'll be connecting to your article as well on our website. It's steinershow.org. And Dr. Eduardo Blumwald, thank you so much for joining us here this morning from the West Coast. And Pat Lavera, always great to have you on the program. We'll continue our look at GMOs and the future of our food. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about hives in the city. No, not itching and scratching. Bees. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We are in the studio now with Allison Gillespie, who is a freelance writer. Her past stories have appeared in Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment, The Bay Journal, The Washington Gardener Magazine, Voice Newspapers, and many more, and author of Hives in the City, Keeping the Honeybees Alive in an Urban World. And welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Nice to be here.
So let's not be terrified of our little friends.
No. Healthy distance.
So, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk at steinershow.org. Your thoughts. Some of you are beekeepers, and we've had a number of people in the city who are raising bees. But talk about why you're focusing on the urban world and bees.
I have a particular fondness for urban ecology. And in my row home in Baltimore, when I lived here many years ago, and now in a pretty urbanized neighborhood in Silver Spring, I've been trying to provide for as many different types of wildlife as I possibly can on a very small postage stamp yard. And I became fascinated with bees in particular and began to wonder about those who were keeping bees in the city, because I knew if I was seeing bees, there had to be beekeepers near me. And I wanted to find out more about them, and the more I found out about them, the more interesting they were, and the more interesting I discovered that their bees were.
So two things. Let me just start with, why would you assume there were a beekeeper if there are bees?
That's a very good question. Yeah, and a really good place to start. Bees are not native – honeybees are not native to the United States. And when they were brought 350 years ago, some of them escaped and were feral. Feral colonies, where bees go off and make a colony on their own and survive without any intervention, used to be incredibly common. And then about 30 years ago, scientists began to think maybe they were completely disappearing from the urban landscape because bees were struggling with so many different problems. And the suburban landscape, and in many places in the rural landscape, completely disappearing. So I had a sense that if I was seeing bees, somebody was really helping me, was a benefactor to my yard, because those bees probably were not able to survive without intervention. So,
Are there more urban beekeepers than we imagine?
Yeah, a lot more. A lot more.
Because there's so many regulations to keep people from raising bees in the cities.
For a short period of time, particularly after some B-grade horror movies about killer bees came out with a lot of not-so-accurate information in them, there was a big fear, a big scare about bees. But the truth is that there have been urban beekeepers since the 1700s, since the 1600s maybe, and they've lived quite happily in urban environments and prospered for centuries. So that is a long, long history. The laws against them are more of a recent thing, since around the 80s. And now beekeepers are learning to overturn those. And even when those laws were in place, I have to tell you, many beekeepers went underground not literally, but they.
But according to your book, they went on the roofs.
Right, right, and they began keeping their bees in camouflage. I met many beekeepers in New York who would tell me they would buy camo and paint their suits to match the buildings where they kept bees. They would paint their beehives to look like HVAC systems, and they just continued to keep them in the city anyway. So
tell me why this is important.
It's a good question. Bees are struggling. Bees are struggling in many locations in the U.S. And really trying to pinpoint what those struggles are about has become very difficult. Scientists are trying very, very hard to find out why the bees are struggling. A lot of people in rural and suburban landscapes feel as if they are inundated with pesticides. And city beekeepers sort of saw this opportunity. Maybe there would be some locations in cities where they could keep bees. That would be sort of away from the heavier pesticide use. Another reason that but why is that important? So why is that important? In cities, we have what has recently been referred to as food deserts, places where there really isn't a lot of fresh produce available, where the food is brought in from far away, is not very healthy. And there are a lot of people who want to do urban farming and bring, you know, the Victory Garden idea back to the city. In order to do that, you're going to need to have your crops pollinated. And so at the same time, there's all these urban farmers wanting pollination, and bees are very good at pollination. There were also people who just purely wanted to help the bees and thought that perhaps the cities could provide a haven for them. So
you know, and I think that people don't really also understand that in urban areas, any area, the critical role that bees play.
Yeah.
In most of the food that we eat, I mean, 3/4 of the food we eat is as a result of pollination.
Right. One out of every 3 mouthfuls of food on your plate. And I always tell people the most interesting and the sexiest or most nutritious food. If you want to get kids going on this topic, ask them about their favorite fruit and then tell them you can thank a bee for that. And for the majority of fruits, that's true. And a lot of nuts, a lot of the things that we eat that we really, really depend on, we need bees. 85% of the globe's plants need pollination in order to reproduce. And bees are responsible for a huge chunk of that pollination. So we really need our bees to be healthy and happy.
So when you put this book together, and you raise bees yourself, right?
No.
You do not?
No.
So tell me about that then. You don't raise bees, but this kind of grabbed you as a subject to write about.
Yeah, I'm a bee groupie. or as Sam Drohian at the USDA says, you're a bee head. And so I'm a bee. I love that term. Yeah. No, I'm a fan of bees only. I don't keep bees. You give me a second. If you say, do you want to come see my beehive? I have a suit you can put on. I've got the suit on. I drive around with a suit in case someone asks me. I would take any chance I can get to climb inside a beehive and look around. So not really climb in, but stick my head in.
But stick your head in.
Yeah.
So what do you discover when you stick your head in?
A beautiful place.
Tell me about, what do you mean by that?
Well, when you open a beehive, the first most immediate thing almost everyone talks about is, so you're suited up. And first of all, you need to be calm to approach a beehive. Most beekeepers, if you come in a grouchy mood, you're stressed, or if they're stressed, they will say, I'm sorry, I can't really let you see my bees today. Because the bees pick up on your feeling, your MO. So,
which is hard for people to, I think, even believe.
I know.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
These little insects, how could they pick up on anything?
And we're talking some of the most cynical beekeepers in the world will tell you this. I mean, this is not just groovy feel-goodness. This is, they will tell you, seriously, they don't like to expose their bees to your grouchiness. The other thing, first of all, you have to put yourself in a frame of mind to relax and pay attention to the bees before you even start. But once you open the hive, the smell that comes out is one of the nicest smells in the world. And there's a feeling that tends to rush over you. And I particularly found myself vulnerable to that feeling, partly because I love bees to begin with and I'm not afraid of them. And so I think I was very open to the feeling of bees from the very start. But there's something there that I believe is chemical that that smells good and feels good and is the same sensation as the word cozy. Mm-hmm. Or almost like getting a hug. There's something very, very comforting about a beehive. The other thing is bees are very orderly. Their society is extremely orderly. Every bee has a role. Every bee has something they're doing. In 30,000 bees that live in a hive, they're all doing something that's towards the greater good of the overall group. So everyone in the hive has got something to do, and there's something about that orderliness that brings you to a state of calm as the human observing.
So you also made some comments also in your book about the fact that a healthy bee population in a city, in an urban area, has something to do with the health and life of the city itself.
Yeah, yeah.
That's also kind of a counterintuitive notion. What does that mean?
Well, and so then you get into the idea of how do we define healthy? So do cities provide a haven? I think it's an open-ended question. I don't think it's a done deal. We know that within cities, the pesticide use is probably higher than anywhere else. And we know that from U.S. geological surveys that tell us that creeks are full of pesticides in urbanized areas. But some neighborhoods do tend to be really interestingly wild and forgotten and neglected in a way that the bees can find a beautiful place to live and kind of not be in anyone's way, and also can find lots of nectar and pollen and thrive. So I think it's very site specific. You can't say that all cities are good. But your question about whether what makes a healthy city environment, I think, you know, when we tend to build cities and we're talking about renewal, we look at businesses and we look at tax income and generating kinds of numbers. We forget so often that even as humans, we need to be part of the ecosystem. And bees have a way of reminding people of that, because in order to have a really good, healthy hive somewhere, you've got to have a lot of growing things that are in bloom. So in some ways, they act as a barometer for a neighborhood and put the neighborhood in a different perspective than maybe a
data sheet. Well, how's that working in our more urbanized regions? And people who live in our inner cities and downtown areas, mm-hmm. people live in the middle of Manhattan, middle mm-hmm. of Washington, D.C., middle of Baltimore. How does that extrapolate out?
So one of the neighborhoods in Northeast Washington that where beekeeping is just a wonderful, wonderful thing to have bees near the Franciscan Monastery, there's a park that they now want to develop. And the neighbors are frantically upset because they love that park and they don't want it developed. They want it to stay parkland. Interestingly, the beekeepers who keep bees at that Franciscan Monastery say, we'll lose, you know, the bees' forage will go way down. That's a prize piece of land for bees. But if you think about it, everybody wants to live near a park. Real estate's always higher near a park. It's just for humans as it is for bees. So in a way, they provide an interesting way to reflect upon our own situation, I think. Some neighborhoods that are down and out, and there's promise there. And some of the first people to see promise in what we might consider a down and out neighborhood are often beekeepers. It's interesting to me that some of the first people to think that a neighborhood has can be redeemed are often beekeepers and gardeners, because they look around and say, but the trees here are beautiful. And, you know, we can start again here. So I think that there's something interesting there that we can learn from observing the bees and thinking about how they need, what they need. Because in a lot of ways, it's what we need. We need green. We need open space.
Yeah, you look in any neighborhoods, I was thinking about that driving through Baltimore the other day, where these whole neighborhoods that have now been devastated by dislocation and end of jobs and people tearing down houses and not rebuilding for the people who live there and with the people at all. But what's been created are these kind of beautiful empty spaces.
Mm-hmm.
That when you talk to many neighbors, they say, well, why can't we just have them? Why can't we use them? Build a park, build a place for kids to play, build a place for people to sit, build a garden, rather than always tearing it down. When I build somebody's high rise up, every time somebody sees an empty space in this world, you have to develop it. It has to be something to be put on it.
So one of the best examples of that in the book, one of my favorite stories, was actually from Hell's Kitchen in New York. And it's a famous story. At one point, Bette Midler even got involved in this part of the story. But one of the worst neighborhoods in New York in the late 70s was just full of crime and violence and prostitution and trash and urban debris in, you know, what is now referred to as the bottom of Hell's Kitchen. And some people got fed up and cleaned it up. And bit by bit started building a garden and immediately realized we need pollinators. And they invited beekeepers in. And that beekeeper was there almost the first or second year of that garden. And what happened was because of that space, that became one of the most desirable neighborhoods in New York. You know, fast forward 30 years later. And at one point, the mayor's office tried to take it over to build on it because it really was just abandoned property with a questionable ownership. And people got up in arms. I mean, really, really angry, including Bette Midler. Bette Midler was so angry at one point about this. So I think, which is fascinating to me. So, and the beekeeper was there on the scene at the very start of that story and still is there. That garden continues and those beehives continue. And they see themselves as an essential part of the neighborhood.
And I think also that people have to get over their phobia of bees.
Yeah.
Most bees, I mean, hornets will attack because that's the nature of a hornet, but a hornet is not a honeybee.
Right. Absolutely.
So, I mean,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I think that that's also been an interesting sea change in the last 30 years because as people realized how bad the crisis for bees has become, you know, we're losing anywhere between a third to a quarter of our bees, according to the beekeepers and themselves. You know, they're reporting every year, and it's generated into the USDA database about it. These are huge losses. And in any other industry, this would be considered unsustainable. The National Guard, if this was cattle, they love to say that if this was cattle, the National Guard would be called out and a national crisis would be declared. But because bees don't directly sit on our plate, we're not as aware of it. But because of those reports over the last few years, people really do care about the bees. And beekeepers tell the story that now everywhere they go, people want to help the bees so much. And they're just overwhelmed by people's support. One of the urban beekeepers I interviewed who lives in Northeast D.C. and grew up in Jamaica and keeps bees in some neighborhoods that other people might overlook in D.C. And he goes to the University of the District of Columbia. He's a great guy, Sean McKenzie. He told me that he thinks it's great. Everywhere he goes, friends will say to him, hey, man, I used to kill bees till I met you.
Right. So. That's beautiful. And I think that we've done a number of shows on bees and honey on this program over the last couple of years. I really think they're really critical to our food system. They're critical to our future and to the beauty of the world as well. And that it's also something that people in neighborhoods like where this university is could be raising bees and getting honey for their families and friends and having this relationship they never had before. And It's not to be kind of minimized, I think.
No, not at all. One of the beekeepers I really loved talking to was Matt Feldman in Philadelphia. And his children go to a charter school that's an environmental school in Philly with a big environmental mission. And the teachers who work there said that beekeeping is this amazing thing for the kids that work there. Matt's dream is that it'll provide an income to some of these kids, and they'll be able to literally be able to make money off of their beehives eventually. But for now, he's just happy to be a part of the environmental ethic of the school. And one of the teachers I interviewed there said, you know, it's funny because in her childhood, she thought of bees as a rural thing. You would encounter them out in the country, and you thought of bees as a somewhere else. And here she is right on the side of a 4-lane high-speed highway with her students behind a big chain-link fence. And she'll go out with the bee suits, and the kids are so excited. And they're so connected to the bees, and they so want to be a part of what's going on with the bees. And they're connecting with nature right there in their immediate area. And she sees it transform their lives and their perspective.
Allison Gillespie is author of the book Hives in the City, Keeping Honeybees Alive in an Urban World. Allison, thanks so much for dropping by. This has been a really good discussion.
Thank you.
Good book and important.
Thanks so much.
Good to have you here. Last month, a former Soundbites intern, Maggie Dyer, visited the offices of Boone Street Farm, an urban farm in East Baltimore. She spoke with Cheryl Carmona and Dana Rushovich, of Boone Street about their farm and got a seasonal recipe for ground cherry salsa.
Tell me a little bit about what is Boone Street?
So we started in 2010 looking for a site to grow food in the city. So our initial hope was really to see if we could grow a substantial amount of food that would be available to people who lived in the neighborhoods around the space that we were growing in. There was a lot of talk at that time about food deserts, and they had just made the map of the city and showed all the different neighborhoods in the city that were labeled as food deserts. And so it seemed to me, I had come from a background studying environmental science and issues around large-scale agriculture, and so I was really deep in the industrial system and learning about the industrial system and how we produce food on a large scale. and living in a city and then hearing people talk about food deserts and just that coming from that background, that's what really pushed me to want to see, well, what's possible in the city? Like, can you really grow enough that it's going to make a dent in, you know, the needs of the community and the residents? And then after we got started and started, you know, working on the land, and, you know, one of the first things I think I noticed was, oh, wow, this is a lot of work. So even though these are really small spaces, it's still a lot of work to grow food. And I feel like that's a really valuable lesson for anyone who's coming from, you know, a neighborhood where you don't really think about where food comes from all the time, you know, and you're faced with choices that are not that desirable or that aren't that healthy. So having an urban farm in the middle of a neighborhood in a lot of ways makes a lot of sense, because you do have increased access, and then you have this ability to talk and get to know people in the neighborhood, and they can participate on the farm, and you really need their participation in a lot of ways, because it's very hard to run a small business growing vegetables and make ends meet. It takes a few years, you know, to get the soil into the right, into good shape to be product, to be especially productive. And what we've been working on this year, this is our fourth season growing on this soil, and we've just really been trying to intensify and intercrop and just really grow as much as possible on a small piece of land. So that's kind of how we got started, and that's where we're, the direction we're heading in right now, is to try to continue to have opportunities for people to be involved at all different age groups. So we have a garden club with elementary school students who can come to the garden and grow food and, you know, make food and learn about nutrition and health and environmental science. And then we have volunteer days where people can come in and, you know, learn how to grow food and eventually maybe have their own garden, or just work with us. And people could also just purchase food from us and, you know, participate in our CSA. So we're trying to make many different ways for people to be involved, for them to be able to get involved and actually get to see and taste and understand the whole experience of growing food, which I think is really valuable. So we're going to do a ground cherry salsa recipe, and we have a lot of tomatoes right now coming from the garden, so we decided to use, this is a good way to use up your tomatoes if you have a CSA share and you're getting inundated with tomatoes. This is a great fresh salsa recipe that you could put on lots of different, as a topping for lots of different recipes. So we started off with our heirloom tomatoes. We right now have a lot of Costelluto Genovese tomatoes, which are actually typically a good sauce tomato, but really if heirlooms have really great flavor and color, and so any heirloom variety tomato will work even, yeah. So for this recipe, you can make about 3 cups of salsa, and we would start with 1 pound of tomatoes chopped and or diced.
And then we would do 1/2 pint of ground cherries, which you would just slice in half. And ground cherries are kind of hard to find, but you could also use peaches as an alternative, which are also in season now.
Okay, and then you'd add 1 small onion diced. It would also be equivalent to about 1/2 cup of onion diced. Okay, so the next ingredient will be 5 cloves of garlic. That would be diced or chopped. Minced is the right word.
And then we used 1 Anaheim pepper, which is a mildly spicy pepper, sort of similar to a poblano. Good one. And that would just be chopped up.
Right. And this is another thing. If you are getting lots of peppers, or you probably can find lots of varieties of peppers at the farmer's market right now. So if you wanted something that was a little more spicy, you could always find a spicier pepper or a sweet pepper if you don't want any spice. We also added 1 dried red chili pepper to add the heat, because we wanted it to be a little spicy.
And then you would use 2 tablespoons of lime juice and 4 tablespoons of basil, chopped up, of fresh basil. And then just some salt and pepper at the end to taste. And then you can eat this fresh or let it sit for an hour in the refrigerator, and the flavors will kind of meld together a little bit more, and it'll be good.
It's best eaten in the first few days after you make it. You probably wouldn't want to keep it for more than a week.
That piece was produced by former Soundbites intern Maggie Dyer. Boonstream Farm will be hosting a fundraiser on Saturday, September the 13th, featuring music, dancing, and karaoke. It'll be at the compound at 2239 Kirk Avenue in Baltimore and will start at 7. For more information, visit boonstreetfarm.blogspot.com. And reminding you, this weekend at Everyman Theater, I'm hosting the World of the Play, Waiting in the Wings, is on Saturday, September 6th at 5 p.m. It's a conversation that grows out of Everyman's Theater current performance of The Understudy. So join our next World of Play panel as we look at what it's like to be an understudy. Who are those folks behind the scenes that you may never see, who may never get to act, and how understanding understudying differs from acting. So get more information at everymantheater.org. Join us next Saturday, September 6th at 5 p.m. for our first World of the Play for this season. And I want to thank all of you for joining us here today here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our productions of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andrea Melton. Our interns are Sienna Greaves and Alex Boston. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, find out information about our guests and what they're doing and what we're doing, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.